Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens. Good morning, America. How's that? Good morning, America. As we move towards the Iraqi elections, Mark Riley, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mark Maron.
Got some campaign slogans coming out of Iraq this morning, because we were talking to some journalists. We talked to Rod Nordland.
Right, from Newsweek.
Newsweek. We tried to get McWare on the phone yesterday. It didn't happen, but...
That was bad luck, because You know, the helicopter crash happened around the time we were on the air, so you know Mick had to go cover that.
Yeah, that was hitting the fan yesterday
absolutely.
in a big way, and Mick had to cover that. Hopefully he's going to be back tomorrow. But some campaign slogans coming out of Iraq for the big election, because we were wondering, you know, how does it work there, you know, and apparently some leaders candidates haven't even been announced. There are platforms of people, but anyways, here's a few. Tippecanoe and Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani too.
Yeah, right.
Compassionate extreme fundamentalism. That's one. Yeah. Everything you loved about Saddam without the torture. Although that's proving
jury's
not to be
still
true.
Out.
That's for sure. Gonzalez is on his way in, but the jury is still out. What was that? 8-10, right?
10-8.
Party
yeah.
line vote on Gonzalez.
Yes, that's so in the Senate Judiciary Committee, I believe.
Help is on the way. It's just tied up in traffic. Okay. Leave no child behind. You'll need them to cover your back while you vote.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I don't like Bush as much as it seems. Wait.
Is that a special one for Alawi?
Alawi, yeah. A kinder, gentler tyranny.
Ooh.
I think that's our slogan here, isn't it? We're going to stop tyranny with tyranny. Don't stop thinking about tomorrow or about sewage. Don't forget about sewage. a chicken in every pot and a bomb in every Toyota.
Oh.
Annex Kuwait.
There you go.
5440 or fight. Hell, forget the 5440 and just fight. What do we care? Anything?
You know what? That 5440 thing, I actually looked it up yesterday while we were discussing it.
Uh-huh.
Do you know what that was? You know what that latitude and longitude is?
It would tell me.
The northern border of Oregon. Huh. I would have thought it was like Texas or someplace, you know. I mean, at that time, this is the 1840s we're talking about.
Uh-huh.
And it was the northern border of Oregon they were talking about.
Wow.
It's unbelievable.
That's
anyway,
way up there. So that was it. What was that about? Can you tell me? Give me a history lesson?
Well, apparently it was about whether or not the United States was going to annex what was then, I guess, the territory of Oregon.
Okay. So I guess it belonged to Canada? Or
no, the British had it.
Oh, the British
still had it, and it was either, you know, we go that far up, or we go to war with Britain.
Geography, not my strong suit, nor politics or math.
No, Google is my strong suit.
Anybody can be a genius with Google.
Google?
Hold on a minute, let me think.
Hey.
It's like if anyone asks you a phone question on the phone, yeah, I think I might know that. Hold on,
hold on.
I remember something, and yeah, oh, of course, it was... 1854 is the Oregon Treaty about the British territory. I'm sorry, I just had to pull that up from my mind. Here's some more. Are you better off than you were 4 years ago? Okay, 4 days ago.
Oh, see.
It's the non-existent economy, stupid. Hey! Come on, people. Please.
It's early, man. It's early. It's early.
I know. I'm not going to get
it's
all
worked
up. It's
only 10 minutes past 6 on the East Coast.
Kalo, how you doing, man? Are you freaking out? Is there any problems over there? Is there, you know, any problems in Brooklyn? Is there any problems with the cup of noodles?
Always.
You know, Costco? Yeah, problems in Brooklyn. No one can get there. What did you tell me, Mark Riley? Not that this is national news, but there was a story here in New York that a homeless man seeking to get warm, you know, built a log cabin and a fire in the subway.
In the subway,
and burned
yeah.
down a switching station, which has crippled the A and C lines that go out to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And then Kalo told me yesterday that property values have plummeted.
Yes.
Because you can't get out there. And now, I don't know if that's true.
600,000 people have been inconvenienced by this little problem. But it turns out now, yesterday, the police commissioner in New York, Ray Kelly, gets on television and said that the initial story that the homeless guy started the fire was wrong.
But it was a complicated myth. I had heard secondhand or third hand that, you know, some guy had bought wood, had gone... Like, it wasn't just like a guy...
Yeah, he was a working homeless guy.
Right, right. That he'd gone out to the forest and cut down trees and brought wood into the subway. No one saw him.
Yeah, his name was Bunyan.
So now... yeah. So now... they say that it's complete fabrication.
They don't know what started the fire. Now they're starting to think that it was some mechanical problem, which, of course, doesn't make the transit authority here in New York look real great. That first you blame it on human error, and now it turns out it was some mechanical problem that probably could have been fixed. But you know what's the amazing thing about that?
What?
When the day after it happened, the head of the transit says it's going to take 5 years to fix. The next day, he says it's going to take less than 5 months to fix.
Yeah, of course.
When people start calling for his head.
When property values start to plummet, Bloomberg makes a call and says, look, we just got the economy going here a little bit. Don't screw this up. Tell them it'll be done next week. Who cares?
Yeah.
Take the Bush approach. You know, we're going to be out of Iraq tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
You know what I mean?
Soon as the election's over.
What do you got to lose? Then just for the next 5 months go, we're almost, you know, the guy's down there with the wrench. It's almost done.
Yeah.
You know, they just cut to a picture of a guy with a wrench in a box. And
well, you know what was the amazing thing about the five-year thing?
Uh-huh.
It didn't take that long to build the entire subway line that's been affected.
Oh, really?
It only took 3 years to build the subway line, and they say it's going to take 5 years to fix a switch on that same line.
I think it was a deep sort of weird conspiracy on behalf of some people within the administration to make people hate homeless people.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking about that. I'm glad you brought that up, because the homeless ought to really form a union or have an advocacy group, the Anti-Defamation League for the Homeless or something, because so the homeless get blamed for so much crap that goes on, not just in New York, but in cities all over the country, Seattle, San Francisco, all of these different cities that have large homeless populations. You know, something goes wrong, blame it on the homeless. Now, that's not to say that there have not been some emotionally or mentally disturbed homeless people that have gone out and created, you know, done crimes in New York. That's mm-hmm. that's true.
Mm-hmm.
People gotten hit over the head with bricks and stuff. And
that was a while
out,
ago. I remember that.
Yeah.
Well, the brick guy.
The brick guy, yeah. He's in jail. Okay.
Yeah.
He's surrounded by bricks.
but
the bottom line is, you know, to blame the homeless for everything is just, and you know, this was, everybody in New York thought this was what happened.
Yeah.
And then to have the police commissioner have to go on television yesterday and say, well, no,
it wasn't
not exactly.
Well, you know, it's a good point you make about that, because I was thinking about this bit I do where, you know, and also there's the assumption that all homeless people are crazy.
Yeah.
You know, like you just use the word homeless for, you know, it sort of kind of.
You can substitute, it becomes synonymous.
Well, a crazy guy who's dressed in rags and, you know, running down the street talking to himself. That's only some of them.
That's only some of them. New York has a, and I think this may be true of other cities that are listening to us as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are working homeless in New York, a substantial number. They number in the thousands.
Yes.
People that are working for a living every day but simply cannot put the money together, the month's rent, the month's security, maybe a broker's fee, wherever it takes to actually get permanent housing here.
That's right. And they can't, or they don't have family, or they don't have anywhere to draw money from to actually get permanent housing. Exactly. And there's a lot of vets coming back from Iraq, apparently, integrating into the homeless population in different cities in Los Angeles. We've got reports about that.
Oh, yeah. A quick story. Where we used to be on 2nd Avenue in Manhattan, there used to be a homeless guy that used to sit out in front of there every day.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that did a show with us on WLIB then, actually, you know, took an interest in the guy. It turned out the guy had like $30,000 sitting in a Veterans Administration account that he wasn't even aware of.
Boy, that must have pissed him off when he found that out.
No, he was happier than a clam. The next time I saw him, he had a Walkman on his head. He was happy as he could be.
Walkman, big new coat.
Yep, exactly. Exactly. But, I mean, it was like, you know, the guy was just out there. He was a nice guy.
Yeah.
He was panhandling. And it turned out he had all of this money. He's sitting there waiting for him.
At least enough to get him started.
Yeah, 30G. Yeah.
And what did he choose to do with that money? Did he get a place to live? Or you don't know. You didn't follow.
I didn't. Well, I think.
Did you see him again? I guess is the big question.
No, he finally left.
Yeah.
We didn't see him anymore. And my guess is that he probably went out and tried to find a job and then tried to find a house.
Well, you know, that's a nice story.
Yeah,
whether you know or not, it ended well, and it doesn't always end well for those people. So let's talk about Alberto Gonzalez, about his next step in this confirmation hearing. It was a party line vote, as you said. So this guy's got plenty of dissent. This guy's you know, Torquemada Gonzalez, the neocon death cult's
new representative,
Legislative enabler. Is that what you would call him? All right, we'll be back in a second. 15 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley. Because two Marks are better than one. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Today.
20 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
It's morning sedition as it is every morning. Hey, folks, we're looking for a spy. That's right. If you've got a kid who's going to be learning intelligent design in school, we want your help exposing what goes on in their classroom. Email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. I will be performing at the Poway Center for the Performing Arts near San Diego on February 12th. I'm pulling out the Jerusalem Syndrome. I'm reprising the Jerusalem Syndrome, which is a one-man show that I did off Broadway for almost a year. It's back. It's all in my head. I ran it last night. I've been running it every day, and I'm doing it at the Poway Center for the Performing Arts. It's a big sort of existential, spiritual journey that's really about grandiosity, narcissism, drugs, fun, brand loyalty. Fitness.
There you go.
It's got it all.
Now, did you adapt it for Black History Month?
I absolutely did. I am black in this version.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Joining the Morning Sedition Book Club, if you're interested, you have a day to read Sam Lechtzeit's Homeland.
24 hours, folks. Get to work.
Which is how I read everything in high school.
I read
when I was in junior high, I read The Chronicles of Narnia one Saturday afternoon. I couldn't absorb any of it. I just sat in the garage and read them all because I had to read them all. I wish I'd absorbed them. It might have changed my life. I might have been a different person, Mark Riley.
Now, did you get quizzed on any of this?
Huh?
Did you get quizzed on this stuff?
Of course. That's why I read it.
For me, like, I would read stuff and swear I didn't retain any of it, but then if I got tested on it, I could spit it right back out. It was easy.
Mm.
You know, I never had a problem. That's why I did really badly in school, but did really well on tests.
Yeah, you do have an amazing ability to comprehend reading and remember things. That's very good. I seem to remember what I want to remember. But I don't remember everything. Like, I have a really good memory for some stuff. But you have to work at it. I guess it comes natural to some people, but I don't remember.
My mother was one of those people that made me remember license plate numbers.
Oh, wow. That probably helped.
It was
drill. I need to do some memory exercises. They have memory exercises for grown-ups, so you don't lose your memories you go on, because it starts to drift. You know, Riley?
Who?
That's your name, right?
Huh?
Okay. Joining the Morning Sedition Book Club, as I said, here's a little taste of Lipsight.
Feeling is not quite the word for the feeling. How's bathing at knife point in the phlegm of the dead? Is that a feeling?
I don't know, but if you're curious about where that comes from, you know, read Sam Lechtzeit's Homeland. He'll be on the show tomorrow. You want to call and talk about his book. I hope some of you read it. It's one of the funniest books I've read in a long time. It'll make you laugh out loud. Also, oppose the Anti-Gay Rights Amendment and the elimination of the filibuster. Go to the links page at morningsedition.com for petitions you can sign.
Yeah, now, by the way, you know, the some of Bush's conservative friends are on his case about not pushing hard enough for the same-sex marriage constitutional
amendment.
That's
right, not pushing hard enough to deny people of their rights.
Yeah, so, you know, when they push, we got to push back.
Here's the intro before we get to the fleshing out of the Alberto Gonzalez. I was going through Stars and Stripes, as I usually do.
As you do every morning.
And this is from a letter in the letter section, Marine Brigadier General David M. Broms. He's retired. And he writes, as retired professional military leaders of the U.S. Armed Forces, we are deeply concerned about the nomination of Alberto R. Gonzalez to be Attorney General. We feel that his views concerning the role of the Geneva Conventions in U.S. detention and interrogation policy and practice have put soldiers in harm's way. During his tenure as White House counsel, Gonzalez appears to have played a significant role in shaping U.S. detention and interrogation operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and elsewhere. Today, it is clear that these operations have fostered greater animosity toward the United States, undermined our intelligence-gathering efforts, and added to the risks facing our troops serving around the world. And this is from a retired brigadier general in the Marine. And it's signed it was signed by like 25 other people, all of that rank or less, Army Brigadier General, Marine Brigadier Generals, Rear Admirals. I mean, these are retired military people who know what they're talking about, who know how this slippery slope of prisoner abuse can lead to a type of anarchy and morale deterioration within the troops. And this is really the brainchild, or at least he championed it, Alberto Gonzalez.
Alberto Gonzalez is going to probably be confirmed sometime next week, but it's very interesting what happened to him on the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Mm-hmm.
He went, obviously, before them for consideration, and the committee voted 10-8 strictly along partisan lines. for his confirmation. That's a pretty close vote on the committee. It will now go, of course, before the full Senate, where people expect it will be confirmed, but by nowhere near the margin that was afforded Condoleezza Rice as Secretary of State, which was 85 to 13. And among the 85 are some people who, in my judgment, ought to know better. Shall I call some names, Mark?
Yeah, why not?
All right, let's talk about Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, who voted yes. John Corzine from Jersey voted yes. Chris Dodd from Connecticut voted yes. Patrick Leahy from Vermont voted yes. Barack Obama from Illinois voted yes.
To confirm.
To confirm. Rockefeller from West Virginia. Salazar from Colorado. Stabenow from Michigan. All these different folks. There were 13 people that voted nay. And they have my undying allegiance and respect. They include the Hawaiian senator whose name is Akaka.
Mm-hmm.
They also include Evan Bayh, Barbara Boxer, Robert Byrd, Dayton from Minnesota, who we heard so eloquently yesterday, Durbin from Illinois, who didn't tell people how he was going to vote when he was asked beforehand, Harkin from Iowa, Jeffords, the independent senator, only one in the Senate, from Vermont, Kennedy from Massachusetts, Kerry from Massachusetts, Lautenberg, our friend Frank Lautenberg from Jersey, Carl Levin from Michigan, and Reed, and I forget his, I keep thinking Jake Reed, but he's a football player, but this is a Democrat from Rhode Island. Republicans did not vote.
Why?
I mean, I guess they were busy.
Oh, yeah, okay, so it wasn't a matter of protest, or it wasn't as opposed to voting yes or anything like that. They were just gone.
They were just gone.
Because their senators are not a lot of
sometimes
times.
Sometimes they're busy.
Of course they are, but if a Democrat did that and he was running for, say, President of the United States, he'd be like, he missed important votes.
Most, yeah.
Over 90 times.
How dare he?
But let's quote, I'd like to quote Alberto Torquemada Gonzalez.
Yeah.
The famous quote is, quote, "The war against terrorism is a new kind of war, which renders obsolete Geneva's strict limitations on questioning of enemy prisoners and renders quaint some of its provisions," end quote.
We're going to get quaint with the two of these folks after the break. There you go. Alberto Gonzalez, Condi Rice. We got some more for you here on Air America Radio.
He rides. Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Booyah!
Oh, how are you, man?
I'm doing good, man. Wait, got one of those energy things.
Now. Oh, that's Ozzy.
Because I'm about to go off on George Bush. That's,
you are?
Well,
you feel it?
Yeah,
let's,
man.
Let's all go off on George Bush. To hell with that guy. Enough of this crap. Neil Gunn, death cult mother.
Anyways, yeah, there you go.
Anyways, we got an interesting palm pilot today. Ramon came in looking a little, he had the 1,000-yard stare, man.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Look like
just, like, look right through
you've seen some, yeah. And he brought us Iyad Alawi's palm pilots. Because, you know, since the Iraq elections are Sunday, interim Prime Minister Iyad Alawi is hard at work on the campaign trail. Here's his palm pilot for today. 8 a.m. Prepare Baghdad for joyous celebration of democracy and my ultimate victory. Prepare spider holes for inevitable descent into tyranny and despair. 9 a.m. Order release of unethical and deceptive attack ads against John McCain and John Kerry. Note. Thanks, W. 10 a.m. Pay suicide bombers to stuff their backpacks with my campaign flyers for maximum distribution. Oh, no. Oh, boy. 11 a.m. Play the Kurd card.
Oh,
2 p.m. Call White House. Tell them all those leftover whip inflation now buttons from the Ford campaign just aren't working. 3 p.m. Send body double to kiss babies in Fallujah. 4 p.m. Get new body double. Note, not too tall this time.
Ooh.
6 p.m. Give stump speech. Accuse other candidates of hiding from the issues. Or just hiding. 9 p.m. Bedtime. Hey, where'd everybody go? Where are my bodyguards? Oh, crap.
Oh, now, man. You're going to make me go to church and have to confess my sins.
Dude, we're evil, huh? Mm-hmm. Call the AARP to find out how you can oppose the administration's efforts to dismantle Social Security. That's 800-846-8610. Oh, it doesn't say that. 800-846-8610. I believe you can find that information out on morningsedition.com. If you can't, you will. I'll get Pashman, son of Louis and Linda Pashman of New Jersey.
You'll hook it up.
So let's get back into this. Gonzalez, Torquemada Gonzalez, outside of, you know, authoring the memo saying the Geneva Convention provisions are obsolete and quaint, he knew, Riley, he knew that his views might undermine the U.S. military.
He knew.
So, to what end? Who was all in on this? You know, in the January 2002 memo, Gonzalez said he was aware of the risk that ignoring the Geneva Conventions could create for the military. It could create a problem, could introduce an element of uncertainty, this is a quote, in the status of adversaries. Translation, it could encourage enemies to use similar tactics, making them more willing to use torture and barbaric treatment as a means of warfare.
This is toadying in the first degree.
Do you think it had something to do with the beheadings? You know, once those pictures had come out, do you think that Abu Ghraib had something to do with the number of Iraqis that were not necessarily ex-Baathists, that were not necessarily jihadists, but were just, you know, pissed off that the Americans were there, and when they saw these pictures, it just put them over the top and said, screw this, we're going against these guys. How do I sign up?
Well, yeah, and see, it works on two levels. On the one hand, it works against, in many instances, civilians, because remember that a lot of the people who have been kidnapped and beheaded in Iraq are, in fact, civilians. It also impacts the military, in that if you ignore the rules of war, why do you think your adversary would abide by the same rules that you ignore? I mean, it's a very, very simple axiom. That's why you've got so many military people, and I think we talked about this even before we went on the air. So many military people are upset with Alberto Gonzalez and don't think he should be attorney general, because they believe that he has taken the lives of American soldiers very lightly by pursuing this kind of, well, we don't have to really pay attention to the Geneva Convention. If you do that, and other people will start ignoring them, and your soldiers will be subject to torture they would not ordinarily be subject to.
And Cy Hirsch picked up on this, too, because Cy Hirsch is very sensitive to the slippery slope of the type of, you know, anarchy and bloodshed that can happen once, you know, the rules are not followed of warfare. And you know, reporting specifically on My Lai,
yes,
in Vietnam, and him being sensitive enough and intuitive enough and having the courage to report on this slippery slope that happens when discipline breaks down in a quagmire. And then, you know, anything goes, and it's just people look the other way. Thank God for digital technology.
Some people would say that Alberto Gonzalez's memo to George W. Bush on this subject was strictly unpatriotic because it does put American soldiers at risk. Now, you won't hear this from the Bush White House. These folks have just got their, I mean, you see Bush had a press conference yesterday, couldn't even mention the worst single loss of life of American troops since the war began. Couldn't mention it.
And did you hear the defense of that? The reason, I think it was either McClellan or one of the other
How weak is that?
He said, well, if we mention one, we'd have to mention all of them, and that would take too much time, and we don't want to be disrespectful to other military families by mentioning one death or 30 deaths or 15 deaths, or how about 1,400 deaths of American soldiers, or how about, you know, 100,000 deaths of Iraqi civilians? How about mentioning death at all? They don't want to be insensitive by mentioning one and not the other. Well, how about just being empathetic and showing a little bit of grief? How about showing a little bit of sensitivity to what some of these families are going through, as opposed to just parading the idea that's like, you know, hey, come on, you got to hang in there. Pretty soon this is all going to work out.
Look, this is, Mark, and you know, the Bush administration people will tell you this. They have actually said this, and I'm looking for the story now because it really struck me when I saw it earlier this morning. Here it is. Now, this is really interesting.
Okay.
This is according to Elizabeth Buemiller in today's New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
The president's words were part of an aggressive White House communication strategy this week and next to frame the risky Iraq election in the best possible light. The goal, a Bush advisor said, was not only to lower expectations, but to avoid any definition of success. Think about that for a minute. Now, this is in the context of the elections, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the bottom line here is you don't put out any bad news. George W. Bush didn't talk about that helicopter crash until it was brought up to him. Why? Because it destroys the frame that he's trying to construct for the elections.
Yeah. And at what point do the American people, you know, sort of wake up and see what's going on here? They're really counting on the fact that this thing gets put on the back burner, you know, by more and more people every time they sort of start promoting these false endings to the war. I mean, this has been going on since the beginning. And we'll get into this a little bit. Frank Rich wrote an amazing piece in the Times today, a very inspired piece that we have a link to, I guess, on Pashman's Picks on MorningSedition.com. And also, we just want to go into how many of these false endings he's promoted and how he keeps pushing the expectations up by saying, hey, we'll get those guys out of there. We'll get our guys and gals out of there when...
Whenever.
When they're ready to take their own country back. You know, and they keep saying it like, you know, like it's around the corner. But from all... You know, from all indications, they don't, you know, no matter how many Iraqi troops they say they have trained, there's only a few of them that are really willing to do the job, and that there's no indication that at least 130,000 American troops aren't going to come home for a couple of years.
Avoiding any definition of success. We're doing great. That's what he's saying. It's as simple as that. He used this strategy in the election, and he won with it, and he's continuing to use it in spite of polling that's starting to say that the American people are kind of sort of getting wise to him.
Kind of sort of. Well, we'll go into exactly, you know, what the, you know, everything, what his definition of doing well is.
Yeah,
all right, 42 past the hour, Air America Radio.
I'm the Reverend Al Sharpton, reminding you that listening to any radio show besides Morning's Edition is officially considered selling out to the man. So keep it tuned here to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
What is it?
Forty-seven past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. We're talking Iraq. We're talking about yesterday being the deadliest day to date in Iraq. 37 troops dead for Americans, specifically.
Yeah.
We have no, you know, hard numbers on the thousands and thousands of Iraqis that have been killed since the beginning of the war on them. But 31 Marines went down in a helicopter yesterday. It's unclear at this time as to what caused that. They're saying weather.
It could have been weather because there was a sandstorm alert apparently for the area, but they don't know whether or not that was what caused the plane to crash or the helicopter to crash, or whether or not it may have been enemy fire at a point that caused the helicopter to crash.
And Bush did not deal with this in any way, did not show much contrition.
Well, he had to be asked about it before he brought it up and came up with a very weak reason why he would not have brought it up at the top of his news conference.
Yeah, the weak reason is that if we have to talk about one death, we have to talk about all of them, and the president doesn't have time for that. You mean you can't craft a statement with all your sort of, you know, religious fanatic genius speechwriters that would accommodate the sadness somehow of the people that are losing people over there? You couldn't pull that off. You can only religify your statement to the world as the new, you know, dominant, you know, the guy who's going to end tyranny, but you can't pull together some, you know, pseudo-religious words of empathy or sadness or sympathy or grief. It's mind-blowing, Mark.
Well, it's mind-blowing because this is part and parcel of the way this administration works. Their focus is on the election. That's their thing. Because
On the Iraq election. Now that they've already, you know,
now
sort of like
kind of scared
the hell out of everybody in this country to vote for him.
Yeah. So now the focus is on the Iraq elections because, as far as Bush is concerned, this is yet another way to frame a victory. He framed the victory back in May of 2003 when he stood on the deck of that aircraft carrier. Mission accomplished. He keeps trying to reframe even what victory is.
Even with the liberation of Baghdad, you know. Yeah, it's like, we toppled the statue. Okay, yeah. And then people are like, yay, let's go home. Wait, we're not. How come? And then, like,
we got
the aircraft character. Yeah. Hey, we got Saddam. We're all going to go home. Wait. Oh, and then it's the handover of sovereignty to the the puppet Alawi. Yay, good. So they got their country. How come we're. And now the elections are the
elections are the elections are the latest way for him to say this has been successful. Now, what they're going to do, and those of you who watch those Sunday morning gas bag shows should be ready for this now. Bush's people, including the just-confirmed Secretary of State, Dr. Condoleezza Rice, will be fanning out on the various Sunday chat shows to talk up the success
of democracy,
as embodied in these elections, where people, I think, in many parts of Iraq, not all, but in many parts of Iraq, are going to be afraid to show their faces for fear of getting shot.
And, dude, even the international community of expatriate Iraqis were, really, they didn't vote, really. 10%.
Yeah.
Right?
10% overall, worldwide,
25%. Fewer than 10% of the eligible voters in the United States and fewer than 25% worldwide, went to polling places. Granted, it wasn't easy to get to
had to drive from, like, Montana to Washington State, it seemed like, to get
that
to.
That was a little crazy. They couldn't do it in mail-in because they didn't have enough time.
Yeah.
It seemed like almost like a last-minute thing.
Democracy, folks.
Yeah, to try to get these. I think this was really, this was a press-op. I mean, the idea that somebody, it seemed at the last minute, said, wait, there are Iraqis all over the world. I mean, if we can get them to vote, it'll really look like
democracy.
It'll
look like democracy's working.
And we've really got something, and they didn't even show up for it.
No, they're not showing up for it. And it's not because they fear for their lives. It's because there really was no expeditious way to do this because they didn't think about it early enough.
And I can't tell you, Bush warned Iran, to stay out of Iraq's business.
Yeah. America
exactly
can go and install governments around the world.
And the way that he infantilizes the Iraqi people is always mind-blowing to me. He says, I'm proud of Iraq and its people. I want to express my admiration for the courage of Iraqis who are ready to develop democracy and strengthen it. It's sort of like, soon they'll get up on their feet. It's almost like this guy, punched him in the face.
Yeah.
And then said, it's going to be okay. Come on. Yeah, come on. Let me help you up. It's disturbing the way that this man-child king, George Bush, infantilizes the Iraqi people who he's just plowed under. And Rumsfeld, I'm sorry to cut you off there, it's like this is a president that's incapable of expressing sympathy or grief properly for our own troops. And then he's got the high priest that oversees human sacrifice in the Pentagon, Donald Rumsfeld, the neocon death cult's overseer of human sacrifice. He has a machine
that signs his name.
And then thank God, at least one of them. I can't even thank God because it's too late. Douglas Fife is on his way out, thank God. But
yes.
What are you going to say?
Yes. What we're seeing now is, again, the Bush administration trying to mold American public opinion. Because I don't think Bush really cares what the rest of the world thinks about what's going on there. But remember that democracy was only a tertiary reason why America is in Iraq in the first place. Remember, and Barbara Boxer, who we'll hear from a little bit later, keeps bringing this up, making Bush very uncomfortable. But the fact of the matter is, we weren't there to install democracy initially. We were there to remove Saddam Hussein because he had weapons of mass destruction that threatened the world. That's what we told everybody.
Right.
And see, the rest of the world hasn't forgotten that. We may have forgotten that in all of Bush's talk about, oh, we're bringing democracy. Oh, see, we're having elections. Wonderful. That's not why you said you were going there in the first place. And people need to remind themselves of that fact every time they hear one of these lackeys on these gas bag shows over the weekend.
Well, it's interesting. Just, in Frank Rich's piece, he says, Iraq is Vietnam on speed. The false endings of that tragic decade reenacted and compressed in jump cuts, a quagmire retooled for the MTV attention span. And it's interesting if you mention, unquote, the MTV attention span, just the attention span of people in general, is that they don't want to think about this, Riley. I mean, they don't want to. I mean, if you got a choice of like two things or three things you're going to think about today, are you going to think about the ongoing conflict in Iraq? Are you going to think about, what you're going to do for lunch? How you're going to feed your kids? And they do everything they can to sort of maneuver this. So when people do think about it, they're like, it's either almost over or like they're going to have elections. You know what I mean? That's sad that people died, but I think ultimately this is the right thing. They simplify it. And when we talk to guys who are in the field over there, you're like, man, this is horrible. I mean, you can't even imagine how horrible it is, and you barely see it on the news unless something awful happens to American soldiers.
And see, 6 months down the road, Americans, I think, ought to be, and it's just my own opinion, they ought to be wondering, why are there still 100-some-odd thousand American troops there 6 months after the elections that were supposed to have democratized the country?
Yeah, and it's like, and now the neocon death cult, the primary architects of it, i.e. Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld and Cheney, they first of all, they don't have a mandate. You know,
yeah.
They don't. And not on the...
They weren't elected except for Cheney.
Exactly. So what you have there is you got a bunch of guys that are just... They've never cared what the population thought anyways. They are going to just stick with this thing. And they don't care how many Americans die, really. They just want to see if this experiment works.
And they also know that Americans don't care how many Iraqis die. And that's a very important component of this, because the fact of the matter is you're not going to bring any kind of democratic system or electoral system to a place where most of the people hate you because they think you're responsible for the number of people who've died.
And yet one of the minor henchmen, one of the under priests of the neocon death cult human
Dougie
sacrifice
Doug.
Wing, Douglas Faith, is on his way out, and he's one of the guys that helped push through the kind of wobbly intelligence that Condoleezza Rice sort of secured for the neocon death cult to do what it's doing. He's on his way out. He's taking a break from figuring out ways to kill people to spend more time with his family.
Let me tell you something. Tommy Franks summed it all up about Douglas Fife.
We should hold that until after the next
yes.
after the top next hour.
Because he had a great word.
I saw that.
Oh, no, I got to say something about this.
That's a quote worth savoring there, no doubt.
Yeah, yes.
It's always good when people that work for a guy hate him just as much as the other side, which is us, hate him.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And when they call him a lightning rod, you know why.
Yeah. All right. So there's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Here are your marching orders today. One, during hearings, urge Democratic senators to purse their lips and snap after calling one of Bush's cabinet nominees a liar. Two, now that the Bush administration has abandoned the phrase coalition of the willing, use it as a name for your swingers website. Come on down. Three, to promote liberal causes, pay off columnists at your daughter's middle school newspaper. Yeah. There you go, kid. Here's a couple bucks. Go to the movies. All right, okay. Here's $9. Go to the movies. Here's 30. Buy a video game. Four, have a protest wine tasting to express outrage over Paul Giamatti being snubbed for the Oscar. And five, today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Rumsfeld's new spy wing has been around for years, man. It's called the Postal Service. They come to your house every day, man. Wake up, sheeple. They're reading your diary right now.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Mark Maron, what did George Bush say about the election in Iraq?
Oh, we're going to hear
about
that.
We're not going to tell you yet.
Right.
Well, what did Tommy Frank say about Douglas Fife? We're not going to tell you that either.
Don't tell me yet.
You got to listen when we come back here on Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, waging a war of words against stupidity. Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Air America Radio at 6 past the hour, and this is Morning Sedition.
That's right. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes. Good morning, Mark Riley. Good morning, America. This is Morning Sedition. I'm glad you all are tuning in and hanging out with me and Mark, because we do this every day, Riley.
Good morning.
Every day.
And we are Americans.
We're looking for a spy, folks. That's right. If you've got a kid who's going to be learning intelligent design in school, we want your help exposing what goes on in their classrooms. So email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. A couple other announcements. Sam Lipside, whose book Homeland is Morning Sedition's first Book of the Month Club. Is that what you call it? Morning Sedition Book Club. Is what we call it. It's the first book of that. And he was here a couple weeks ago, and here's a little taste. Here's a little taste of some Lipsight.
We didn't have squash at Eastern Valley. We didn't have tennis either, unless you count that trick with the steel hairbrush and the catgut racket, whereby the butt skin of the weak was flayed.
Lipsight is one of the more impressive wordsmiths and satirists of his time, and the book is hilarious. You still have a day to read it if you want to call Sam. He's going to be on the show in the last half hour of the show tomorrow. That's around 8:30 Eastern. Also in the news, no name calling week. I've brought that up a couple of times. I've gotten into a little flack for my use of words, and people are the idea is that this is put together by the Gay, Lesbian, and Straight Education Network. It bases some of its momentum on a book called The Misfits, which deals with four much-taunted middle schoolers, one of them gay, who run for student council on a platform advocating an end to nasty name-calling. The book has sort of inspired this. And it's about name calling of all kinds, you know, dealing with race, you know, appearance, background, you know, what people like to do. And, you know, I might have been a little insensitive in my use of some words yesterday, but I think that, you know, all words should be sort of, you know, free to use on some level, because I think ultimately that's what disarms the power of words. But apparently that is not really true, certainly not in the liberal camp. And it's very interesting. As I was thinking about this going home on the train yesterday, I went by our main office at Air America, and I picked up a book by a compilation of essays that was put together by a woman named Rebecca Walker. It's called What Makes a Man? 22 Writers Imagine the Future. And it's basically about men talking about the male identity. And I just was browsing through it to perhaps, you know, find a guest or use her as a guest. And the first essay is about her kid, her 11-year-old son, coming home from school. Now, this is a sensitive kid, a very nice kid. He likes science fiction. He plays chess. He's got a lot of sort of broad, thinky, sort of softer elements of man children, and all of a sudden he comes home and tells his mother, says, I got to get into sports. And she'd never heard him express any interest in sports whatsoever. So the mother asks her 11-year-old son, and this is Rebecca Walker, I believe, why do you want to get into sports? And the kid says, because I think girls will like me more. And then I started to think about, the whole essay is really about how cultural norms that, are enforced through, name calling, through, high school and junior high and even elementary school sort of social behavior among kids, that this stuff is ingrained in us, and that, we really have to fight a fight. Everyone has to fight their own fight. Like I was always sort of a hypersensitive kind of, arty kid. My mom was a painter. When I was in high school, I liked to write poetry and into, new wave music and punk music. And I was always sort of, thank God I was funny. Because, I did get a lot of, I was called a wuss at times, and I was always, I was bullied a bit. But thank God I had the wit and the cleverness to sort of, throw it back at these guys without them really knowing they'd been hit. That was my great gift, is I could make fun of a moron, a jock moron, right to his face, and he'd think that he would, he was being flattered somehow.
What did you just say?
Exactly. Kind of. And then I'd be like, cool, man, see you later. Did that guy just, I don't know, hey, there's Sandy. So anyways, what I was thinking about when I brought up this stuff yesterday is that, maybe I was a little insensitive in my approach to name calling, because I had to fight it my whole life in the sense that it defined me. I at least had the wit and the wherewithal to be, introspective and self-assessing enough to know that this was going to be a fight for the rest of my life. And I never got into sports to appease anybody. I never did, a comedy that would appease anybody. But it really helped define who I was, at the risk of some of my more sort of sensitive elements. And this is an interesting thing.
Well, it's fascinating because I'm a little older than you. And when I was coming up, virtually everyone, regardless of capacity, regardless of, how well they could play any particular sport, everybody did sports. Everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you could. If you couldn't hit a baseball with a 2x4, you mm-hmm. still ended up playing baseball. You played this sport. It was part of, the acculturation of the time. And as I got older, I realized that there were certain sports I did well, certain sports I did very, very badly in. But I also realized, particularly coming up in the environment that I did, that the way you deal with people messing with you was to literally just like make them feel like crap. Okay.
Yeah.
I was about the business of developing the verbal skills. I used to be able to play the dozens, and a little bit about the dozens.
Do it every day.
Yeah, well, I could play the dozens with the best of them. I mean, me and Wayne could do this for the rest of the show.
Sure.
Because that was how we dealt with name-calling, bullying. Look, when I first went to Connecticut, I was 7 years old, going on 8. Went to Connecticut. The first white person I saw when we moved to Connecticut walked up to me, rubbed my skin and said, "Does the black come off?"
Mm.
Now, how do you react to that? I mean, what, you punch him in the face, which was one of the things I thought about doing.
Mm-hmm.
But you eventually develop, by the time I was 10, 11 years old, I developed snappy responses to anything these people had to say to me.
Yeah.
To the point that I didn't, I really didn't worry about, name calling or bullying or that sort of thing. Because there was always a way to get even. First of all, if you acted crazy enough, they stopped messing
sure,
with
and
you,
also,
bully or not.
I think that sometimes when the name callers call the names, at least you know who they are. You know, a lot of times, you know, when people whisper, there's something more damning to me with five kids sitting there going, as opposed to just one kid going, hey, Woods! Then at least you're like, okay, that's the enemy. That's the guy that I've got to outwit. That's going to be the bane of my existence for the next 4 years or 8 years or however long I have to go to school with this numbnuts. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So if they identify themselves, at least you know who they are. I'd much rather them call me a name than sit there and go, because that it kills me even more. And the only time that I've been, you know, like actively hostile in, you know, in name calling is only when I get cornered and I'm in, and I've been angered, you know, and I'm like, you know, somebody's pushed me to the limit. And I usually, it's like I make up things. You know, I'm not going to use any of the standards. I'm going to figure out what's really going to hurt the person.
You didn't call them like poopy head or something, did you?
No. You just, there's a cleverness to it. But it is a very damaging thing in a lot of ways. But, you know, later in the show, in the next hour, we're going to ask people to call us with their experiences of either being bullied or being called names or actually calling people names. It's not really a confessional segment. But, you know, what do you do about this? Because this has been a tremendous preoccupation with the liberal agenda in terms of reframing language. And some of it is out-and-out censorship. And I think it is absolutely censorship. And that is one of the reasons why I used to appear on Tough Crowd. That's one of the reasons why, you know, I do comedy. There is such thing as liberal censorship and political correctness that is damaging.
Hey, right here in New York, you see what happened on one radio station where at first they weren't going to suspend people from doing this whole tsunami parody
right.
that a lot of people took umbrage about.
Right.
And now they've suspended those folks indefinitely.
Right.
So there is a level, there's going to be a level, certainly when it comes to broadcasting, but you know, most of us aren't broadcasters. Most of us have to deal with this in our own personal sphere. And when you start, you know, realizing how, I mean, look, I got into a fight with a guy one time when I was about 9 years old. Guy called me the N-word in the movie theater during the course of a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And we went outside after the movie was over and we fought for 2 hours.
Got really?
Beat me. Yes.
2 hours?
What, 2 hours.
Did you take breaks?
Yeah, we did. Because there was like a crowd gathered.
Were there rounds?
We took mutually agreed upon breaks.
What?
Yes, we fought for 2 hours. He beat me, but we later became friends.
That's always, that happens a lot sometimes.
Yeah, it
when,
does.
When you get into
I'll
the
never
worst
forget
dependent.
The guy's name. Richard
yeah.
Murphy. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so, you know, apparently about 5,100 educators from 36 states have registered up to 4,000 from, that's up 4,000 from last year. Participation in this no-name-calling week has spread. So we're going to talk about this at the top of the eight. We'll share a little more personal stories about the power of names,
yeah.
and hopefully we'll get some calls around that. Our president is definitely a bully, and we're going to hear from him in just a second. It's Air America Radio, 15 past the hour.
Who are these people? Morning Sedition.
On record, it's out. It's no secret anymore.
Morning Sedition. Edition from Air America Radio.
What? Twenty past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yes.
Morning Sedition. You're listening to Air America Radio. Yesterday, President in charge, Doofus in charge, the faux Christian, bull monkey, AWOL puppet of the Cheney regime's neocon death cult, made a statement that we will hear moments away after my dream diary. I go to the therapist today.
Ooh.
I'm delivering a pizza. I ring the doorbell. You know where this is going.
Uh-oh.
A woman answers the door wearing a black leather corset, hip boots, and a latex cat mask. It's Condi.
Wow.
I gulp. Here's your pizza, ma'am. Condi flashes her eyes at me and says, you're late. I hate to be kept waiting. It seems like everyone gets in my way nowadays. Drops a sweat form on my upper lip. I say, sorry, ma'am. She says, put the Barbara Boxer on the table. I said, Barbara Boxer? Box! I said, box! Put the box on the table, you idiot. She gives me a smoky look and opens it. Steam covers her face. She leans over right in front of me, breathes in deep and says, the meat lover's special. Pepperoni and ham and beef. Wow, this is wrong. So wrong. Why am I trembling? Slowly, she walks over to me and with half a smile says, how much do I owe you for all your trouble? It was no trouble. $12.50 plus tax. She raises one eyebrow. $12.50 plus tax. You're not cheap, pizza boy. Do you want that in cash or some other way. Cash is fine. That's fine. Very good, Cash. I'm thinking, run now. But I can't, or I won't. I hate myself. She ran a fingernail across my chin. Then I'll have to get my wallet. This way. She takes my hand and leads me to her bedroom. Must not faint. Her bedroom is pink and frilly with a canopy bed. Weird. I hear a click, then another click. I look down and she's handcuffed me to a giant teddy bear with the eyes cut out. Condi takes off her cat mask, gives me an evil grin. I think you should know, she says, grinding her spike heel into my chest. I don't tip. I woke up and my bed was filled with shame and wonder. How do you like that, Riley?
Well, you and Condi, man.
That was pretty hot.
Yeah.
I think it really was pretty hot. Man, yeah. All right.
Do you write for one of those?
No, I don't. You know. They. Hey, so George Bush, the president, apparently, is unwilling to acknowledge the disparity between his own statements about Iraq and the reality of Iraq. I'd like you to listen to this.
We anticipate a lot of Iraqis will vote. Clearly, there are some who are intimidated. I urge all people to vote. I urge people to defy these terrorists. They're afraid of a free society. I anticipate a grand moment in Iraqi history. We've been having this discussion a couple of years ago, and I just stood up in front of you and said the Iraqi people would be voting. You would look at me like some of you still look at me with a kind of blank expression. People are voting. It is a grand moment for those who believe in freedom.
That was from a press conference yesterday given by the apparent president who has no mandate. Now, Douglas, faith-based initiatives
there you go.
To suppress proper information channels is on his way out. He, of course, is an under-priest overseeing human sacrifice for the neocon death cult in the Pentagon under Donald Rumsfeld. Now, Mark, this guy, we thought he would go a long time ago, along with Stephen Campone, along with possibly Rumsfeld
himself.
And he is just quietly resigning. And this is a guy that General Tommy Franks said of Fife.
Uh-huh.
And Bob Woodward's plan of attack, quote, I have to deal with the stupidest guy on the face of the earth almost every day, end quote. The stupidest guy on the face of the earth. Okay, he was in the Office of Special Plans, which was designed by Cheney and Rumsfeld, yes?
Yes, he was actually the guy who structured the post-war strategy in Iraq.
Wow, genius.
Now, we see how that's turned out for him. I guess he is spending more time with his kids, because if anybody took a long look at his track record in defense, who would hire him?
Yes.
You know, but believe me, he's got several gigs. He's going to be on the board of about 25 corporations. He'll be a lobbyist for some widget maker that does business with the Defense Department, where he used to be. That's how all these guys end up.
But the bottom line is that, you know, he gets to walk away from the carnage that he helped design for whatever reason. He says he wants to spend time with his family, but this is a guy that, you know, helped, you know, a memo by Fife that went to the Senate Intelligence Committee in August 2002 presented conclusive evidence, that's in quotes, of a collaboration between Saddam Hussein's government and Al-Qaeda, which turned out to be not true. All right. Mm-hmm. Instead of using experts, the Office of Special Plans relied on Ahmed Chalabi for information on what post-war Iraq would be like. This is Ahmed Chalabi, the raconteur, the criminal, the embezzler.
Yeah, this is like asking Denise Rich's husband, who obviously is in exile someplace, a little bit about strategy for America.
Douglas Fife intentionally excluded experts with experience in post-war nation building out of fear that their pessimistic, worst-case scenarios would leak and damage the case for war. This guy was a bastard. He was a covert bastard. And, you know, and he was, you know, doing the bidding of the neocon death cult, you know, in an underling way, which makes it questionable why he's resigning. I mean, it's not like he's come out of fire, under fire as of late, unless something was about to break that we don't know about. We should keep our eyes open for the next few days.
Well, you know, it's funny. He was below the radar for a while. His name came up at the beginning of last week, and really, you know, he's given no one. He's done a couple of public interviews during which he gave no indication that he was thinking of resigning. So I don't know exactly what it was, whether he's, you know, figuring that his work was done because the elections are coming up. I'm not exactly sure. But, you know, if in a just society, Douglas Feith would never work again. And in a just society, he would have to stand before the families of some of those 1,400 Americans who died in Iraq and explain exactly what the he was thinking.
Right. It's just interesting about the histrionics of this memo that I talked about before, making the connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. Because Dick Cheney, later called this memo, quote, your best source of information.
Yeah.
And then George Tenet told the Congressional Committee in March that Cheney was mistaken about its reliability. Feith's memo was never endorsed by intelligence agencies. So this guy basically was the guy that pulled out, you know, the false intelligence to justify the war, and Condi Rice signed off on it. I imagine it's the same stuff. It's the same information.
Oh, it's exactly the same stuff. This was Feith said that there was conclusive evidence of collaboration between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein's government, something that has since been completely and utterly debunked.
Well, we're going to talk to an assistant secretary of defense and also a fellow at the Center of American Progress. He used to be in the Reagan administration, Larry Korb, after this, about these new super secret spy brigades.
Stay with us. This is Air America Radio.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley, Mornings Edition on Air America Radio.
The Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of The Shadow Government.
Deep in Washington, D.C., lives a group that has the ability to cloud citizens' minds. What evil lurks in the heart of a shadow government? Mark Maron knows.
When last we left Mark, his search for Colin Powell had led him and Kid Rock to a dark basement in Washington, D.C. But they weren't alone.
I couldn't believe who was staring me right in the kisser. Ronald Reagan.
Well, not exactly.
How do you like my little experiment, Mark?
Alberto Gonzalez, how did you find me again?
It's not really Ronald Reagan. It's Ronald Reagan 2.0, an evil clone built from stem cell experiments paid for by Nancy Reagan. I brainwashed him and turned him bad. Very, very bad. Ah!
Leo, can I kill him now, Senor Alberto?
Patience, 2.0, patience. Now don't let that friendly voice and grandfatherly demeanor fool you, Marin. He's my own private killing machine.
Will, I really want to kill him, Alberto.
I told you no. Now move or no dog food tonight.
This is freaking Kid Rock out. I gotta get out of here. I want my mommy.
Mommy? Kill, 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 kill.
Kid! Did he really just break me in half? Oh, my life is flashing in front of my eyes, dude. Boobs, boobs. Walmart, Hot Pockets, Jack Daniels, Pamela's boobs, my old Chevy. That's about it. I'm out of here.
2.0, strap Mr. Marin to the table. I'm going to introduce him to my own personal media conspiracy.
Hey, ow! Come on! Let go of me!
Sorry, but no one can resist my superhuman strength and my cornea ocular charm.
He was right. Within moments, I was strapped down to a table and stretched out worse than the Army Reserves in Iraq.
All right, Mr. Marin. They don't call me the torture master for nothing. Now let's see how tough you are, buried under a ton of garbage.
I have here a set of facts from the Internet, which indicate that liberals get all their facts from the Internet.
Oh, my God.
Gunshot.
What could be worse than listening to Rush Limbaugh?
Lesbians are delivering our mail.
Now, I'm going to release these disease rats, and they're going to swarm all over your body.
Oh, my God. What could be worse than listening to Rush Limbaugh?
I've trained these rats to go insane with hunger when I sing the opening lines of It by the classic soft rock group Red.
I'm going to drive to Georgetown, call into the radio station, and sing it over the air. By the time I get to the touching second verse about a man being in two places at one time, you'll be right, child.
I was trapped. The rats swarmed over me like 50,000 Ohioans trying to cram into a single voting booth. When all of a sudden, a dame appeared from behind a secret panel. She was a number, all right, as curvy as a congressional district redrawn by Tom DeLay and almost as hot as the polar ice caps in about 30 years.
Need a hand, Seamus?
I'm kind of particular about who saves my life. Who are you and what's your angle?
Let's just say I got my reason. Careful while I cut these ropes.
But wait a minute. Now I'm told we have one of my favorite people on the line, Alberto Gonzalez. Buenos dias, Alberto.
Good afternoon, Rush. I just want to send a message to a very special friend. If a picture paints 1,000 words, then why can't I paint you? The words you never show.
Let's get out of here. That song is stirring those rats into a murderous rage.
It had the same effect on me in high school.
Who is this mysterious woman? What plans does she have for Mark? And how can Ronald Reagan have an evil clone when the original Ronald Reagan was also evil? Come back next time when we hear Ronald Reagan 2.0 say,
"We'll be right you again."
That's next time on The Shadow Government. And tune in later as Morning Sedition Radio Theater debuts its very first blaxploitation drama, starring a veteran radio newscaster. Wayne Gilman is News Daddy.
I swear, man, I don't know what you're talking about, man.
You wouldn't be holding out on News Daddy, would you?
No, Daddy, I swear, I got no idea how to get stories online from Newswire when the server goes down.
Then I guess there's only one way you're making deadline. 12 floors down.
My, you're some kind of man.
That's right, Brown Sugar. And now I'm going to invert your pyramid.
Ooh, what's your name, stranger?
I'm Wayne Gilman.
That's News Daddy. Later on, Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
All right, 39 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley on Morning Sedition.
No, I'm Wayne Gilman.
we're laughing it up in here. Had the whole team in here. Clutch Larson was in, P.W. McDonald, Kalo, the Costco Ho, Mark Riley.
Well, he's in here all the time.
Gilman came in to laugh it up. Dan Pashman, son of Lewis, and Linda Pashman. Elon, the intern, was here. Big party here at Morning Sedition right now on the phone to discuss Donald Rumsfeld's new strategic support branch, the super-secret spy reconnaissance black ops folks that are going to be running around the world. Is somebody that should know and understand about this type of stuff. He's a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He served as the Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan. He is Lawrence Korb. Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Good morning, Mark. I'm doing fine.
Good morning.
Great to have you on. So did you know Douglas Fife?
Yes, I did. When I was in the Pentagon, he was like the third ranking official in the Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs office.
Could you see the seeds of evil in him then?
Well, that was an interesting group. You had Richard Perle, Frank Gaffney, and Doug Fife, and I told people as you went down, it got more and more scary.
You felt some sort of weird heat emanating from the room?
Yeah, I mean, more and more sort of hawkish and unrealistic in terms of, you know, the way the world worked and the way the United States should deal with the threat.
Do you think this is just a standard resignation? Do you think that there is something about to come out? Do you think, there's anything suspicious about him wanting to spend time with his family at this point in time?
Well, no. I think that's the standard way in which people, leave office in Washington. You never say, you know, I'm fed up with this job, I've had enough, or, or I'm being forced out. It's always, I have to spend more time with my family. There was an official not so long ago who said, you know, he was leaving to spend more time, and his wife was not well. And the next day she came out in the paper and said, hell, if he was concerned about my health, he wouldn't have taken the job.
Larry Korb, I got to ask you, Tommy Franks had an unflattering quote about Doug Fife in Bob Woodward's book. He called him the stupidest guy on the face of the earth.
Yeah, I mean, I would call them rigid. I mean, in terms of, and if you think that if you're not willing to sort of look at the world the way it is, you know, that just certainly doesn't mean you're very bright. And I think that's what General Franks was referring to, because you know, you come in with a preconceived notion about how the way the world works and the way the role the United States should play, and you're not willing to change that based on the evidence and the facts as they're presented to you.
Larry, I want to get into the strategic support branch and these and the history of these type of operations and what it means for these operations to be moved almost exclusively under the auspices of the Pentagon as opposed to CIA, but we need to take a break. Will you stay on with us?
Okay, sure.
Thanks a lot. It's 42 past the hour. We're talking to Larry Korb here on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
It's just a wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about this before.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Emerging.
Forty-seven past the hour. It's Mark Maron with Mark Riley.
Yes, it is.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. On the phone with us from the Center for American Progress. He also served as an Assistant Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan as Lawrence Korb. Larry, tell us a little bit about the strategic support branch that is within the Pentagon. Why did they need to develop this? Why did they have to take this responsibility of running this black reconnaissance out of the Pentagon? It's usually in the CIA. What is the power move on this?
Well, a couple of things. Don Rumsfeld felt that the CIA was too risk averse to take the chances necessary to get the intelligence he felt was needed, because the CIA, as you probably know, has been burned over the years, and after it was discovered in the 70s some of the shenanigans that they had pulled, that they have to get a presidential finding, and it then you have to notify the intelligence committees in the Congress, and many times that'll keep people from doing things. So he felt that, you know, by getting the Pentagon to do it, he wouldn't have to go through all those roadblocks, because there's nothing in the law that says that those type of operations have to be approved by the Congress. Now, I think as the Congress finds out about this, they're going to make sure that the law is written in such a way that you would have to notify the Congress about these. But I mean, that's the basic reason. This enables him to go ahead and do these things without really going through all of the checks and balances in our system.
Let's talk about some of the things that these guys can do now without any transparency at all, in a complete secretive environment, without any approval from Congress. What are some of those things?
Well, I mean, what they can do is they can go into a country, and in fact, in the memo that was leaked to the Washington Post, they talked about countries like Somalia, Yemen, Indonesia, the Philippines, and Georgia. They can go in, and if Cy Hirsch is correct, they've probably already been in Iran, scout out what are the potential military targets that you might want to hit if you start war, to try and, use an intelligence term, turn some of the people in there that could provide you information. In other words, recruit people to help you. And even carry out some covert missions, like blowing up an ammunition dump, or trying to break up a terrorist cell.
Could they also set up some of these extraordinary renditioning operations, these outsourcing of torture and whatnot?
Well, I mean, that's again, if you capture someone, then question is where would you bring them? That's a whole other issue about what do you do if you capture someone? Do you bring them back to the United States, or do you turn them over to quote unquote one of the friendly countries in that part of the world
that will do the bad things we can't do
right
here?
Larry Korb, I was really kind of surprised quite frankly, some of the tepid reactions from people on Capitol Hill to the existence of this strategic support branch. Senator John Warner, after being briefed along with Carl Levin by Stephen Cambone, came back and said that he thought that this whole strategic support branch idea was a good one. Usually, Congress people hate not to be told about things. How do you reconcile that?
Well, yeah, I'm not surprised at Warner, but more at Senator Levin, who's certainly seemed to be more concerned about the powers of the Congress. Now, it could be, you know, when they briefed them, they talked about the fact that they were just, sort of preparing the battlefield rather than doing some of these other things that we spoke about. But the fact of the matter is, once you allow them in there, then, you know, things can get out of hand. And I am surprised. Now, Senator McCain, had a different reaction. He said he wants to hold hearings and find out, you know, what's going on there.
Yeah. Now, when Pentagon spokesman Larry DeRita was in full denial mode, he said that the strategic support, he said that there was no such organization within the Defense Department that reported directly to Donald Rumsfeld. A day later, he acknowledged the existence of the strategic support branch. Is it possible that this branch does not report directly to Rumsfeld?
Well, I mean, they were playing with words. They said it's under the control of the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, but the fact of the matter is the Defense Intelligence Agency reports to Rumsfeld, you know. And in fact, you may remember when Cy Hirsch first wrote about this, they basically ridiculed him and said, you know, he didn't know anything. And then the Post came out and they, you know, tried to deny that. But, by the next day on Monday, the 24th, they had to admit, yes, this group does exist and it's been, you know, doing a lot of these things. You know, it's not new. In the summer of 2002, there were press reports about this. And I did a thing for the New York Times with a colleague of mine, I was then at the Council on Foreign Relations, said the military shouldn't be in this business. Well, the story kind of died. Well, fact of the matter is the press reports that came out then were accurate because we now know that this thing has been going on since 2002.
And it was known as Project Icon then?
Yes, that's right.
So now let's get right into that then. Why is it problematic for the Pentagon to be involved in covert operations, and how does it undermine the power of the new post of Director of National Intelligence?
Well, what would happen basically is that the Pentagon would do it, and it would not be coordinated with the rest of the intelligence community. I mean, the new Director of National Intelligence is supposed to ensure that the right hand knows what the left hand is doing. And in the Post story, there was a high-ranking CIA official quoted said, "Gee, this is news to me. I never heard of this." I mean, and again, that's the problem. I mean, let's say the CIA is in there and the Pentagon is in there. I mean, it could lead to confusion. But the other thing that you really need to focus on. It's one thing to have CIA or intelligence people in a country. All countries, do that. When you send a military person in, that's different. There are different laws and regulations that are applied, and you can't deny it. And what do you do if this person's captured? I mean, what happens if we had an undercover, a special forces group in Hamburg, and they went to break up a terrorist cell in Hamburg and ended up in a, firefight and killed some German policeman or something. I mean, it's a completely, completely different type of thing when the armed forces are involved.
That happens, I mean, that's sort of what happened with the Black Hawk Down situation, isn't it? They were unknown, that most people didn't know that those operations were taking place.
Well, yeah. I mean, we were in Somalia, though, under a UN auspices, but you're right. If there had not been UN auspices, if we had been in, say in some of the countries that are mentioned, they're not going to tell the country they're in there. And you know what happens if they discover you got U.S. armed forces in a country? That you can't deny that. I mean, if these brave people get arrested, they're in the service. You know, they have ranks and everything like that.
Mm-hmm. Larry Korb, Mark and I were speculating about a couple of things when this whole story came out. Maybe you can debunk or maybe even confirm this for us. We were curious about whether or not the Strategic Support Branch might have had some small role in what went on at Abu Ghraib. Are we nuts?
Yeah, that's a completed. That's a different, a whole different, different thing. I mean, the problem there is that you had this, to say the least, very ambiguous guidance coming down from the White House and through the commanders, and pressure on these people to get information and kind of in a no holes barred environment.
Well, the reason why we were questioning this was because General Janice Karpinski, when she was talking about what happened at Abu Ghraib, she talked about people that she didn't know that showed up in civilian clothes and seemingly took over the interrogation of some prisoners in Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, well, that, again, this is not undercover. You're there. I mean, we're, you know, we've, you know.
Right, right.
It's so not undercover. And I think what happened there, some of these people in civilian clothes were probably with the, as they say, with the agency. And we, they also had some civilians there. I mean, this is a whole other mess that you have on your hands here.
Mm-hmm. Larry Korb, what do you think the public's tolerance for this sort of black ops strategic support branch operation is? I mean, do you think most Americans believe that this is a legitimate way to defend the country?
Oh, yeah, I think they do. I mean, because they haven't thought much about it. They think, hey, you know, these characters attacked us on September 11th, so let's go get them, and, you know, kind of, you know, a no-holds-barred thing, and if the, you know, the special ops people can do it, let's do it, and let's not be bound by, you know, quote-unquote rules and regulations. I mean, during the Cold War, for years, people tolerated a lot of things, and it wasn't until the 70s and after the horrors of Vietnam that people were willing to listen to people like the late Senator Frank Church and the former Vice President Nelson Rockefeller, who investigated these things and said, hey, wait a second, these guys were going around the world trying to kill people.
Doing whatever they wanted.
Yeah.
Now, quickly, last question. Rumsfeld's future, what do you see?
I think he stays through the end of the year when they finish what they call a quadrennial defense review, which is, you know, has to be done every 4 years. It kind of lays down what type of military forces we'll have for the next decade. They've already started that now, so I suspect that they will leave him there through that, and that's due out no later than December.
Well, thanks a lot for talking to us, Larry Korb. We really appreciate the information.
Thanks, Larry.
Nice to be with you.
Take
okay.
care.
Bye bye. So
you know what he just said that just struck me?
What?
He said they're going to keep him there. That's real interesting.
Yeah. So who's holding
who's
those
things?
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow, we got another hour coming up.
Okay, we're going to get ready to tell us your name-calling stories, either as a caller or a callee.
Yeah.
Because later in the hour, we're going to talk about that and the implications of name-calling and then other stuff, too.
Yeah, a whole bunch of other
Why
stuff.
Not?
Yeah.
Air America Radio.
Past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition.
Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor. The pigs are out of the tunnel, to quote Hunter S. Thompson from 1980. The pigs are out of the tunnel. It's going to take us 4 years to corral them back in and put them back where they need to be. But they are out of the tunnel now, my friend. How are you, Mark Riley?
I'm not eating no swine.
I know you don't. I know you don't. Now, you know, we've been talking about this early in the day. We talked about it yesterday, this no name-calling week, which has become very popular. This is the Gay and Lesbian and Straight Education Network has sort of built this week around this story, this book, The Misfits, which deals with four much-taunted middle schoolers, one of them gay, who run for student council on a platform of advocating an end to nasty name-calling, which was the inspiration for this week. And apparently, 5,100 educators from 36 states have registered. It's up from 4,000 last year. Participation in related writing, music, and art contests rose from 100 students last year to 1,600 this year. So this is encouraging a week where there's basically no bullying through name calling. And, you know, we've been talking about this. We have a president, Mark Riley, who is an innate bully, who is it's his first impulse. He's quick-witted in the way that he's able to be hateful and defensive and egocentric. And, you know, we have a clip from just yesterday, the press conference, where somebody asks him a question about something that he gets defensive.
Yeah.
And as opposed to just talk, he gets his feathers rustled, and then he actually says that you're acting like a senior citizen. You've got a faulty memory. Let's hear that.
Yes, Ken, follow up. This is a homeboy follow up.
I can't remember a time in Texas on another problem, taxes, where you tried to get out in front and tell people it's not a crisis now, it's going to be a crisis down the line. You went down in flames on that one.
Let me, if I might. I don't think $1 billion tax relief that permanently reduced property taxes on senior citizens was flames, but since you weren't a senior citizen, perhaps that's your definition of flame. Yeah.
What is there about government?
You're not a senior citizen yet.
Yeah, what is there about government that makes it hard for government to get
faulty memory
to address things in advance before it's a crisis?
Do we have a crisis in Texas now, school property taxes?
Yes, we do.
Thank you. Can I get some order here, please?
You know, it's interesting. So, because he went on the defensive, he took a pop at that guy by being ageist, by being, you know, stereotyping, you know, senior citizens, and then, you know, insisting, like, once he felt the first taste of laughter from, you know, the part of the press corps that was there that loved this guy and just loved to see him be defensive and loved that he's narrow-minded and all his tough love horse crap. You know, they feed him, you know, and he felt that second round. He's like, hey, I'm doing good here. I'm going to take another shot. You know?
I thought he was really going to go after the guy's mother or something. You know, I mean, there is a kind of infantile quality. And I say this as one who has used these kinds of linguistic devices himself in the past. I have to be honest about it. You know, somebody starts something with me, I go for the jugular.
Yeah, me too.
I want to disembowel that person verbally.
Yeah, me too. But disemboweling somebody verbally is not essentially the same as, it doesn't have to be the same as name calling. I mean, you know, you can pick certain characteristics of that person and just sort of, you know, hit them where they're weak without being stereotypical and without, you know, characterizing them in a certain way that is racist or ageist or playing on a stereotype.
No, you're absolutely right. And this isn't the first time that Bush has done this, obviously. I just found a story going back to 2001 when he was in Crawford, Texas, and he was being questioned about some stem cell research and started making fun of the fact that the reporter who asked him the question was bald.
Mm-hmm.
You know, same kind of logic. You know, well, you're a bald guy. And the guy said, he said, you're a fine lad. A little short on hair, but a fine lad. Now, I got to be honest. That's the kind of stuff that, you know, I have kind of, in my older age, I guess, learned how to put a governor on that sort of thing. Because when I was younger, you know, somebody stepped to me with something verbal, I would step right back in their face with something verbal, and I didn't lose that often.
Yeah, but that's different than name-calling and the sort of dangerous, you know, element of name-calling, which is that, you know, by characterizing somebody in a stereotypical manner or using a racial slang or a slang based on somebody's, you know, potential, you know, sexual preference or gender or what they come from or the types of habits they have, you know, it's very different when you generalize because you're isolating someone from a group. And,
yeah.
You know, this is one of the things that, you know, I got some flack yesterday from, you know, using, you know, for saying the word faggot and then saying the N-word, you know, not saying the N-word, but using the phrase N-word.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody says, well, why would you say that and still say faggot? You know, why, you know, and, you know, I filter myself because, you know, there are some things I think are inappropriate. I self-censor. And, you know, but then, you know, why did I? Why did I feel comfortable to say the word faggot? You know, it doesn't hurt me necessarily, but it obviously hurts somebody else. You know, it's a word that I've used, you know, when I've had friends that have called me that, you know, but in a different way than it's used in a hateful way. And it's a very weird sort of, it's a weird area. This thing is, it really got me going.
Language
yesterday.
Is always a weird area because it can be interpreted so many different ways by so many different people.
And the thing was, is like, you know, when I was talking earlier about when people identify themselves as either, you know, a racist or you know, just a Cro-Magnon idiot, you know, who is like, you know, hey, faggot, you know what I mean? It's like, you at least you know who that guy is and you know who to stay away from. And that was another thing about, like, when I did Tough Crowd, okay?
Mm-hmm.
This was a show that would encourage you to embellish the stereotype that you could be associated with. And characterize yourself as such and tell jokes from that point of view shamelessly, you know, sort of freeing, you know, and sort of disarming, you know, whatever stereotype that would have been, whether it was black or gay or Jewish or liberal or Republican. I mean, that show really encouraged people to behave like the stereotype that they were if they did actually possess some of those, you know, stereotypical behaviors.
But did it accomplish its stated end? Did it really free up the language to the point that people who saw it saw the language differently?
Well, I think what it did do was, you know, I guess the real issue is the reason why there are stereotypes sometimes is that, you know, some things, you know, are true, aren't they?
Some things are true, but stereotypes can, and certainly the black experience in America has been, you know, prima facie evidence of stereotypes being untrue. Black people worked as slaves in this country for 300-some-odd years, or, I'm sorry, 200-some-odd years, yet were still stereotyped as being lazy.
Right.
Now, that wasn't true.
Right.
We worked for free, our ancestors.
Right.
But we were still stereotyped as lazy.
Right.
that is not a stereotype that was based in any way, shape, or form on truth. Yet it became a common stereotype in American life.
Right.
So there is, and there are situations where people can, yeah, there are some things that are true.
They're mostly, lifestyle and behavioral choices, you know what I mean? Sometimes those kind of stereotypes can be a little more true than those horrible ones that were developed in, like, the Renaissance, like, you know, Jews as moneylenders or, you know.
Oh, yeah. But now, let's look at a common current stereotype, that Asians can't drive cars,
mm-hmm.
okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't have any statistics that say that Asians are more frequently in accidents or are the cause of more accidents than whites or blacks or Latinos or anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, that stereotype has become, I mean, it's become part of the routines of dozens of comedians.
Well, sure, but to the point where it's enculturated, like, you know, we are enculturated with it to the point where if you see someone driving badly, you know, how many people, when they drive past a car,
let me tell you,
an Asian, go, oh.
Look, let me tell you something. I was in Oakland years and years ago.
You want to save the story?
Yeah, I'll save the story.
You know, the real question we're putting out to you, are we taking the calls now? No, we're going to wait? Okay, well, you know, I want to talk a little bit about how, you know, Lenny Bruce, you know, dealt with some of this and you know, the two different, and we'll hear your story, mm-hmm. and we're going to engage our listeners. It's 15 past the hour on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Ramon, you know, looking like battle fatigue, brought us Ayad Alawi's Palm Pilot this morning. Since Iraq's elections are Sunday, Interim Prime Minister Alawi is hard at work on the campaign trail. Here's his Palm Pilot for today. 8 a.m. Prepare Baghdad for joyous celebration of democracy and my ultimate victory. Prepare spider holes for inevitable descent into tyranny and despair. 9 a.m. Order release of unethical and deceptive attack ads against John McCain and John Kerry. Note, thanks, W. 10 a.m. Pay suicide bombers to stuff their backpacks with my campaign flyers for maximum distribution.
Ooh.
11 a.m. Play the Kurd card. 2 p.m. Call White House. Tell them all those leftover whip inflation now buttons from the Ford campaign just aren't working. 3 p.m. Send body double to kiss babies in Fallujah. 4 p.m., get new body double. Note, not too tall this time. 6 p.m., give stump speech, accuse other candidates of hiding from the issues, or just hiding. 9 p.m., bedtime. Hey, where'd everyone go? Where are my bodyguards? Oh, crap. All right, we are talking about name calling. It's a very broad topic, and we're going to try and focus the topic in just a minute because I guess the real issue is when you're in middle school, when you're in junior high, when you're even as young as grade school, you know, what impact does it have in your life, and what did it do? Because I remember when I was in high school, there were several different groups. You know, we had the freaks, we had the jocks, we had the ROTC people, we had, you know, I was proud to be able to sort of move freely. I was a free agent. I could move freely through the freaks and jocks. And the weird thing is also about bullying is that, and name calling, is bullying has a trickle-down effect. You know, if a parent bullies their kid, the kid will go bully other kids at school, and then, you know, someone's dog's going to get hurt.
Well, it's funny because it certainly in the high school I went to, there was a great deal of bullying, and it was sanctioned because it was a military school.
And so, well, what was that story you can tell about Oakland?
Well, you know, I was out in Oakland one day, and I was staying in a hotel, and I went downstairs to get my car, and this Asian lady was pulling out of a parking space and drove right into this pillar, backed into the pillar, I mean, at full speed.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sitting there, and I couldn't help Mark. I swear to God, I felt so bad. I started laughing my face off
mm-hmm.
just because it was like it fulfilled that little stereotype. But again, people don't have real numbers to back up a lot of these stereotypes.
Well, that's the thing is once it becomes enculturated, then it becomes sort of accepted behavior. And even if you don't say those things, you don't think those things, you don't want to believe those things because, you know, it has become a cultural archetype.
Yeah.
You know, you laugh when you see it involuntarily. And that's the danger of these type of that type of stereotyping. Now, on the other level, you know, when we're talking about, you know, gender stereotyping and the type of bullying that goes on in grade school and in junior high and in high school, which is what this no-name-calling week is really about, is what repercussions does that have and how you deal with it? I mean, Lenny Bruce, you know, really argued for freeing the language, for, you know, really working the First Amendment till the end, which is, you know, if you use all the words and you level the playing field, they lose their meaning to some degree. And on some level, you know, I believe that, you know, it's never been, you know, actually enacted in any sort of effective way, because ultimately what happens is, you know, bullying groups or groups that are being bullied start to, you know, take back the words that were used to hurt them and then take ownership of them, which I think increases separation on some level. I don't know.
It may increase separation on some level, but different groups do that to varying degrees.
Sure.
Within their groups. There, you know, again, you don't generally find Asians talking in a derogatory fashion about other Asians. You just don't.
I don't know.
At least not in English.
I know that, you know, in the groups I'm in, you know, as far as, you know, comics or Jewish people or however I want to characterize myself, but I always find that there is a certain amount of that that goes on, that, you know, you do talk negative about the other people in your group and to the people in your group, and there's a certain understanding there. But in talking about high school, you know, like in my experience in high school, because I was sort of a sensitive kid, but I wasn't, you know, what I would call, you know, what you would get called a geek. I wasn't a geek. I wasn't a nerd. Mm-hmm. I wasn't a dork. But I wasn't a jock either. I was sort of a sensitive kid. I was, you know, sort of an art department kid. I'd definitely been called wuss or the other one, or fag, I've been called. And, you know, it's just like, what effect did that have on me? It provided me a certain defense mechanism. It got me sort of toughened by that. I mean, yeah, my feelings were hurt, but I think in retrospect, you know, because I had the ability to, you know, to outwit people and also to, you know, to get people on my side and show the stupidity of whoever was calling me that, you know, I was empowered by it. But I think it has other repercussions for people.
Well, you know, I mean, what do people do when, for example, the artsy kid in school is also the star quarterback?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not outside the realm of possibility. It creates a great deal of inflexibility in people's minds further down the road. You've got guys that play in the NFL who do have extraordinary range of skills. There's one guy who's a great jazz pianist.
Yeah.
Denny Green, who coaches the Arizona Cardinals, is an accomplished drummer.
See, that makes him a wuss. That makes me upset.
Why?
Because in my heart and mind, jocks should just be jocks. When they do something that I can appreciate, I find it very disturbing.
Well, you know, it's funny because some people in the athletic establishments find it very disturbing. I remember hearing a story about a basketball player who decided to go to the Metropolitan Museum here in New York one day, and his coach tried to physically prevent him from leaving the hotel room.
There is the problem. You see, even in my heart and in my mind, you know, at some point, because of my sensitivity and because of my personal interests, I decided to react against them and, you know, become what I thought was some sort of, you know, drug outlaw. You know, like, you know, like, you know, when I was in college, there was a point in time where I decided, like, you know, after the whole beatnik thing, and I was Mr. Poetry Guy, and, you know, sort of like, you know, wandering through the world with complete wonder and sort of inebriated excitement, that I got jaded. After I got into comedy, I became, you know, more defensive, a little more aggressive, more hostile, probably a little more sexist in my, you know, in my attitudes, mm-hmm. and it wasn't me. And that's one of the problems with these reinforcements of cultural stereotypes. Is that you put a barrier on a kid's ability to fully develop himself.
Yeah.
866-303-2270 if you want to, you know, pipe in here and, you know, and get involved in this conversation. We'd love to hear from you, because it's very it's challenging. It's exciting stuff.
Yeah, it is. And I'm curious whether people think that intergroup name calling results in more intra group name call. In other words, are people who call each other names within the group more likely to stereotype and call people names outside the group as well?
Yeah, any other way you want to pipe in as well. It's 866-303-2270. We'll talk to you in a second, right?
Yeah.
No, we got a little more time.
Well, we got a little bit more time, but not enough time to take a call.
No, we're not going to take a call yet. But, you know, because, like, you know, I had to deal with my own guilt when I was driving home yesterday when I was on the train, you know, because I remember, you know, I forget sometimes, you know, what it's like to be called names. I'm very sensitive. If you were to start a dozens game with me, you know, my first instinct when you took the first shot is like, really? That's what I was able to... Are you serious? You know, and then I have to regroup. Like, unless I'm cornered and angry, you know, I don't really... My first reaction is not to call, you know...
See, my first reaction is to surgically go after... And it's almost a reflex, because
wow.
I was taught. I was really taught by the best.
So where are you guys at? 866-303-2270, Air America Radio.
Join the Morning Sedition.
Right now?
Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Yes. Hello. Hi. How are you? What? I was looking down, Kalo. 34 past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
On Air America Radio. What are you going to get mad at me, Kalo? 866-303-2270 if you were called names or you named caller. Come on, you wussies.
Oh, see. Right. You're going straight to hell now.
Yeah, again?
Yeah.
How many times do I got to go there before I get this right?
Thrice.
Let's take this first call. Oh, you know who it is. Since our president is openly operating in a different reality, we think it's important that Americans know what's happening in his alternate universe. Luckily, we have a staffer who lives in that world. So now on the phone once again is Planet Push correspondent Lawton Smalls. Good morning, Lawton.
Hey, good morning, Mark. God's stuffing the ballot box, and every vote leads to heaven.
Oh, heaven. Yes. Okay, so let's talk about it. Let's talk about the election in Iraq this weekend.
Oh, yes. Isn't it wonderful that the Iraqis came out and voted in such huge numbers?
What do you
President Bush has truly planted the flag of freedom in Iraq.
Hey, Lawton, the election hasn't happened yet. It's not till Sunday, Lawton.
I know that. You don't have to beat me like I'm a ignorant stepchild.
Yeah.
Now, come on. Let me tell you something about the spirit of the Iraqi people. They're not going to let a little thing like insurgent mortar attack stop them from voting.
Uh-huh.
They'll take one look at that flag of freedom waving in the breeze, and they'll just walk right in with a firefight. It won't be a problem.
Look, Lawton, listen to me, buddy. We all want the Iraqis.
Waving in the breeze!
We all want the Iraqis to vote, but why should they have to risk their lives to do so? All right?
Here's the thing. I think the Iraqi people will be inspired by our example. After all, Americans risk death every time we go to vote.
What are you talking about?
Well, okay, elections are in November, right?
Yeah, okay.
Well, that's cold and flu season, my friend.
Oh, my God.
And have you ever heard of a little thing called
unbelievable.
Fleet?
Yeah.
All right,
yeah,
Americans
okay.
defy billions of terrorist germs and slippery sidewalks that hate our freedom just to uphold democracy. Iraqis notice these things and believe me, they'll imitate us.
Lawton, how can you possibly compare the threat of a terrorist attack with the threat of a sore throat, man?
Well, I'm just blessed with that sort of mind. That's all.
Oh, my God.
I think we need to come together and just back burner all those negative stories about Iraq. PMA, positive mental attitude.
Yeah, okay.
That's what the Iraqis need from us, not your fancy reporting and facts.
So what are you saying, man? So let me get this. You want everyone to be in denial. Is that it, Lawton?
Everyone. Okay. Leave no Iraqi behind. That's my motto. Now I realize denial's not just going to happen overnight. It took America 200 years to arrive at the point where less than half of our citizens actually have to go to the polls and vote.
Oh, man.
So if just one Iraqi manages to make it to the poll, or really even half that number, it will have all been worthwhile.
Wow,
this whole thing will be perfect, I think.
You know what, dude? You know what's scary?
Wave.
You know what's scary, Lawton? You really believe that, don't you?
Wave.
You really believe
flags
it, don't you?
Flags of freedom.
Come on, Lawton. Really?
The flag.
Really?
Really? The flag.
Really? Come on, you wussy. Come on. Oh, there you go.
Oh, I was going to be okay until you called me name. I heard that about the name calling.
It's
not fair. The whole thing's a mess in Iraq. We don't have enough security forces to protect them. Hell, if I lived in Iraq, I wouldn't vote Sunday. I spent Sunday locked in the basement rereading Valley of the Dogs.
Yeah, you're right.
I wouldn't come out till Wednesday.
Bush and Rice and Rumsfeld.
Why should I vote?
That's right. They all talk a good game about democracy, but their actions have failed the Iraqi people. That's what I'm saying, right?
Why must you always blame the administration, Mark? I said it was a mess. I didn't say it was their fault. Come on.
Oh, man.
Vote or die, Iraqis. Vote or die.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Wonderful day.
Yes.
Plant the flag of freedom.
Thank
God
you.
God loves you. Deal with it.
Oh.
Vote or die.
All right, Lawton. Thank
I'll
you.
See you, buddy.
Okay, you take care of yourself. Let's take some calls here about names. Stephanie, listening to the mic in Madison. How are you, Stephanie?
Hi, Stephanie.
Hi, Mark and Mark. How you doing?
All right, how you doing?
Good. I had quite an experience with name calling in high school.
Uh-huh.
I was born with vision, pretty serious vision impairments, which have gotten worse over the years. Now I'm basically legally blind.
Sorry.
You never know it because I can see, but it's affected mostly my reading.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really tormented in high school to the point where I didn't fight back. I didn't really know what to do. I don't know if it was just not my nature. I've learned, however, you know, when to do it and when not to, but it was really painful. It affected me for years.
Like what they torment you with?
Well, it was mostly the guys.
Yeah.
Sometimes the girls, they were more, you know, just kind of like dissing me. I mean, I wasn't attractive in high school. I became attractive later, but the guys would, you know, make hissy noises, hey, stuffy baby, you know,
uh-huh.
and yell really filthy things.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes if I had trouble seeing something, you know, I'd get, and this was even like later on, I was like, you know, blind bitch, things like that.
Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. You
wow.
know, blind, you know, you ugly blind, you know,
yeah.
glass-eyed babe, you know, things like that. And I felt, I mean, there were times I didn't feel like I was human. You know, I mean, when I was in high school, and I was considered, you know, really bright and really, you know, loved people, but it was awful, and I got through it, and I think the only, you know, gift I got out of it, really, I feel like in some ways I can identify with people who, you know, people who experience racism, other types of prejudice. I know, you know, it's not, some ways they're not parallel, but some ways I think there's some definite parallels, and I feel a lot of empathy for us.
By feeling marginalized and ostracized and isolated.
Right, and then people assuming that they know what you're capable of and what you're not capable of. People making assumptions about you that they don't, you know, without knowing anything.
Yeah.
Which is really, it's painful.
Well,
you know?
Well, thanks for sharing your story, Stephanie.
We appreciate it.
What's that? What?
Can I just say one quickie thing, too? I think President Bush was bullied, you know.
As a kid?
Yeah, there's something there. I mean, I think, I don't know if he was because of he has some type of disability. I don't know what it is. If it's, I've had friends who think he has ADD or dyslexia. You know, I'm not a diagnostician. I'm not a doctor. But there's obviously something going on there.
Yeah, I think he's certainly a pathological narcissist, and I think he was a spoiled child and very entitled. You know, I don't know if he was bullied. I read.
Maybe that's that whole rich kids thing. You know, hey, you know, you're the one. Unless everybody in his classes were, you know, equally loaded.
You know, what's interesting about Stephanie is that, you know, because of her experience with it, you know, she's able to be somewhat sympathetic for the monster that's running the country.
She's not real bright.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, thank you for calling, Stephanie.
Thanks Stephanie.
A lot.
You take care. All right, so let's take one more before the break. Chris, listening in Maine on WLVP. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Mark and Mark, how are you?
All right, how you doing?
Good, good. Guys have got me totally weaned off public radio.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yeah. So listening to the story, and I'm thinking, okay, so I was a target of name-calling myself. I had lots of freckles. I still do. I had glasses.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like there was a lot of that. But my story really is about this name-calling incident. And I was maybe, I don't know, 11, 12, and my buddy EJ and I used to holler stuff at people at random, for no particular reason, you know, blacks, people we thought were Jewish. I mean, there's only one temple in our town, which is a...
Well, those are reasons. Yeah.
Yeah. Stereotypical suburban New Jersey town. Anyway, and there was no consequence to any of this. And so one day, I was hollering out the window of my parents' bedroom on the second floor of my house. This girl was walking down the street, and I called her a spear-chucking Zulu jungle bunny, and that's about all that I can say on the radio. But there was a whole other string of epithets, and I was on the phone with EJ at the time, and I'm laughing, and he's laughing. It was just, oh, it was so funny, blah, blah, blah. Well, like 30 seconds later, there's this ferocious pounding on the door downstairs, and I go down, and there's my next-door neighbor, Les, this man in his mid-30s, and he's Jewish, and he has got a lecture for me. And he proceeds me to rip me up one side and down the other in a way like my parents never have. Now, he doesn't threaten me. He doesn't call me a little pinhead or anything like that. But he tells me that I'm now at the top of his doo-doo list, and I will wear leather glasses for the rest of my life, whatever that means.
But why did you call that person those names? I mean, well, you know, why did you?
Well, because I wanted to be cool to EJ. It's about the only thing that I can think. You know, at the time, it was like I was going along, and that's what EJ and I did. And EJ was, you know, one of the...
So you wanted EJ to accept you? Now, was EJ, you know, prone towards bigotry and this type
of... I got this stuff from him, because this is not how my parents talk. Now, this is not to say that my parents weren't without their own faults. My father loved to get his super Irish Catholic mother up in the dither by sending her, you know, St. Patrick's Day card that had, like, a Martin Luther King stamp over the leprechaun's face.
Oh,
and that she would get...
A racial bomb thrower!
Oh, really? And then, you know, really wanted to fry her biscuits, so we went to the Baptist church for a while, and gave her an attack of angina, literally.
So there is some sort of, you know, family legacy of some of this.
Right, but it wasn't this overt kind of, you know, like, out-and-out name-calling kind of stuff. And so Les tells me all this, and the thing with the leather glasses, which I still to this day don't understand. But he ratted me out to my parents. It was very interesting how they both reacted. And, I mean, they were subsequently divorced a couple of years later. But
over this incident?
One can only wonder.
Uh-huh.
But Pop said, you know, well, how would you like it if someone called you a Mick? Because, you know, being Irish. And I'm like, I have no idea what that means.
Yeah.
So I'm not offended. Hey, you know, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And he's like, well, you got to be careful who you say these things to, because someone's going to put a knife up against your throat in an alley one of these days and cut your gizzard out. And that was basically what he had to say about that. My mother, on the other hand, said, you really need to read The Diary of Anne Frank, because you have no idea what it is that you're saying or the context of the things that you're saying and the impact that it has on people. And it's not just about the name calling, it's just where it snowballs from there. And, I mean, there were other incidents, and I mean, and certainly this wasn't this, you know, huge life-changing event, but I do remember it with real clarity to this day. And I never did apologize to that girl.
Yeah, have
and,
you made amends some other way? I mean, there is, because it does sort of imply a certain amount of, you know, cultural insensitivity, obviously, and you know, that, you know, you would feel like you wouldn't have any conscience about that at the time.
Right. Well, you know, and the other thing, too, is that in fifth and sixth grade, how much social consciousness do you actually have?
Well, that's true. You do want to do things that, you know, to be appealing to your friends. Thanks for your call. I really appreciate it, Chris.
I understand where Chris is coming from, too. I mean, there's that streak in some people that, you know, makes you want to be friends with somebody. And if that person is of a certain mindset, you tend to replicate that mindset because that's the easiest way to be friends with
people who are full of hate and anger. You know, that sometimes looks like charisma to some people. 866-303-2270 is our number. You know what we're talking about. We're talking about name calling of all kinds. We'll be back with your calls after this. It's 46 past the hour, Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition.
We are the highest rated, most respected news show in America.
On Air America Radio.
Having...
All right, let's land this thing at 50 past the hour. Mark Maron, it's Mark Riley.
Oh, yeah.
It is no name-calling week. The New York-based Gay and Lesbian and Straight Education Network has deemed this no name-calling week, based loosely inspired by a book called The Misfits, and apparently 5,100 educators from 36 states have registered. That's up from 4,000 last year, and we are talking about name-calling and name being called names.
But you know what? Some people are not happy. Some people are not happy with no name-calling week because gays are involved in it.
Well, that's part of the Christo-fascist zombie brigade of the neocon death cult. They have what I like to call the assault on tolerance.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, these people just sort of like, don't tell these kids that it's okay to be gay. That's just part of the liberal conspiracy. These people are dangerous to everything. Here we go. Richard in Seattle, KPTK. What's going on, Richard?
Hey, Richard.
Hey, Mark and Mark.
Yeah.
Pleasure to speak with you both.
Nice to talk to you, man. What's up?
Well, first of all, I just have to say I think Air America is vital to America.
Mm-hmm.
I think you guys are way funnier than Franken.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And I think that you got to bring back that button. We're fighting for our lives.
I am. I take issue with that.
I had to say that.
Yeah.
I missed it. But the main thing is this. It's a two-parter. You've asked recently about dreams.
Yes.
And I love your dream diary, by the
way.
I have a cat that visits me still.
Okay.
A 20-year-old cat who died a few years ago, and he still visits me.
Wow. That's nice. Okay. Well, what about the name-calling thing?
But the name-calling thing is, when I was in junior high,
mm-hmm.
I endured a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was names, and it was like kids in shop class would spot weld these little pieces of metal and hurl them at me.
Really?
I mean, it was really ugly. And you know, vacillating between suicide and... you know, just anger. I also understand when you talk about, you know, you just let loose on somebody once in a while.
Yeah.
The rest of them back off.
Sure.
I've seen that before.
Oh, hey, I've been there. I mean, I'm not proud to say I gave one kid a concussion running his head into a radiator.
Wait a minute. Did I go to school with you? Did I go to... You didn't go to school in Connecticut, did you?
It was a totally urban, white, punk, you know, neighborhood. But, you know, every once in a while, I read a lot. They always said I read beyond my years, whatever that means.
Who said that? That's a fairly...
The main point is this, that you know, I would fight people and blow up at people. And then one night I had this dream where I was wrestling this guy that looked like the biggest, nastiest professional wrestler. You can bald and big and bean and burly.
Uh-huh.
And he wrestled me and pinned me to the lockers
yeah.
and took my wallet.
Uh-huh.
And he ran away like he'd need to run away.
Yeah.
And I chased after him and I... tackle him and I wrestle him again and I fight in the biggest battle you could ever imagine and
yeah.
I grab my wallet back from him and I run away. And then I remember I had these hippie friends. He said, look, if something's chasing you in your dream, you stop. You turn around and you confront it. So in the middle of this big, dramatic, you know, heart pounding dream, I stop. I turn around and I look at this guy and I go, why are you chasing me?
Uh-huh.
And the guy stops and like it's a theater play, he stops. He's suddenly very calm and he says, because I'm what you would have been if you were as big as I am.
Wow.
Wow.
That's
and
deep.
It was like it was an epiphany. I woke up immediately, and I go, oh, and everything that is, you know, my smart-ass mouth. Oh, I can't say that, can I?
No, you did.
Well, you already did.
But, you know, I mean, just I would antagonize people because I read these things, and I was reading Freud and Fromm and Maslow, and I had all these psychobabble words in my mouth.
Yeah.
And I would just shred people. I wouldn't insult them racially.
Right.
I wouldn't insult them financially or culturally. It was just... this is what you're doing, and I would just rip them new ones.
Yeah, so how are you doing now? You're okay
well,
now?
Now I'm just a culturally and economically deprived progressive liberal. I work from home. I survive on eBay. I got a three-year-old kid who when he calls me poopy head,
yeah.
I say, you know what? You can't call people names.
Okay, well, so you've actually learned something. Thanks for calling, Richard. Appreciate
it. Thank you for your time, gentlemen.
Yeah.
Take care, Richard.
Yeah, it's interesting when that stuff sort of happens in dreams. I don't know, you know, the welding thing. There was too much information.
No. Shop glasses.
The worst.
Yeah. They were the worst. Especially metal shop glasses.
All right, let's talk to Chris before we run out of time here. Streaming in Connecticut. Hi, Chris.
Hey, Chris.
How you doing?
Good. What's up, man?
Well, I like the idea of this week off from name calling because for me it was a full-time job and I would have liked a week off, you know.
Yeah.
My last name is Fish.
Yeah.
And people used to say, fishy, fishy in the brook, Papa catch you on the hook, Mama fry you in the pan, Baby eat you like a man.
You're kidding me, right? You got to be kidding me.
No.
Come on, Chris.
No, I'm not kidding.
Where'd you grow up, Chris?
Manhattan.
Manhattan. You must have went to a sort of a, was it an upper-level school?
No, well, it had an IGC track, what they called an IGC track, which
right.
was supposedly intellectually gifted children.
Yeah.
I'd like to get back in touch with that inner child. I'm supposed
what do you want, your tax money back or something?
Thanks for calling, Chris. Thanks for calling. It's good
talking. Thanks,
Chris. You know, it's weird. You know, people definitely have some stories. I don't know if we got to the bottom of anything here, but it was definitely a provocative topic.
Good catharsis.
Yeah. But I, you know, it's weird that everybody seems to do it, not unlike the liberal confessionals, is that at some point in your life, you were either a name caller or you were called a name, and either you learned
or
from
both.
It or you didn't. It seems to be, you know, I'm going to do a little research. I'm going to read, Clutch Larson loves Steven Pinker. I'm going to try and, you know, get some sort of, what does this mean to the gene? You know what I mean?
Huh.
How does name calling, you know, either sort of obliterate someone's ability to survive or encourage it? There's our liberal agenda for today. Here we go. One, during hearings, urge Democratic senators to purse their lips and snap after calling one of Bush's cabinet nominees a liar. Two, now that Bush administration has abandoned the phrase coalition of the willing, use it as the name for your swingers website. There you go. Three, to promote liberal causes, pay off columnists at your daughter's middle school newspaper. There you go, kid. Here's $5 to go to a movie. What, it's 10 now? 15?
What?
All right. two to or four, have a protest wine tasting to express outrage over Paul Giamatti being snubbed for the Oscar. And five, today's phrase, just drop it in the conversation. Rumsfeld's new spy wing has been around for years, man. It's called the Postal Service. They come to your house every day. Wake up, sheeple. They're reading your diary right now, man.
Man, it's been a fast morning, Marin.
It has, actually.
And tomorrow's going to be fast, too, because your boy Sam Lipsight's going to be here. Have a good one. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, fighting treason with reason on Air America Radio.